Good evening and welcome to the KRFP Evening Report for Tuesday, October 18th, 2016. I'm Lee Robartis in the news tonight. Dworshak Dam managers will have more difficulty than usual this winter managing water levels as largest turbine is refurbished during the winter and next spring. Governor Otter, Idaho Fish and Game, and wealthy business interests exchange emails about what to do about the Idaho Fish and Game's refusal to allow more game tag auctions. Moscow Streets and Fleets Division Manager gives details about recovering from large water main break in August. And we'll have the last of our legislative candidate interviews with Paulette Jordan, running for Idaho House Seat 5A. All this coming up in the KRFP Evening Report and more. And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. Managers at Dworshak Dam near Orofino may have a more difficult time than usual balancing competing missions of flood control, providing water for salmon and steelhead, and maintaining water quality because contractors will be refurbishing the dam's largest turbine all winter and part of this coming spring. The number 3 turbine is the largest of 3 at the dam, meaning U.S. Army Corps of Engineers dam managers will end up releasing more water from the Dworshak spillways, which will increase dissolved gas levels in the North Fork of the Clearwater River below the dam, possibly killing fish and other aquatic organisms important to river ecosystems. If dam operators draw down the reservoir sooner or to a lower level than normal to ensure dissolved gas levels remain low, there may not be enough winter snowpack to refill the Dworshak Reservoir for summer. The Corps usually tries to reach full pool at the reservoir by July 1st, and then the agency begins releasing water intended to cool the lower Snake River, which increases the chances of survival for threatened and endangered salmon and steelhead runs. The Lewiston Tribune reports, with the turbine repairs this winter and spring, there will be reduced release capacity through the turbines, but dam managers may have to resort to using the dam's spillways if there is a significant snow or rain event, which will increase dissolved gases not only in the North Fork of the Clearwater, but also downstream in the main stem Clearwater a mile below the dam. The Nez Perce tribe is concerned any rapid increase in water volume released from the dam could harm the juvenile fall Chinook salmon they raise at the Nez Perce tribal hatchery at Cherry Lane or at a salmon smolt acclimation site they own near Peck. The Idaho Wildlife Federation made public a cache of emails this week, which highlighted the growing political animosity between the Idaho Fish and Game Commission and some state legislators. According to the Lewiston Tribune, the Fish and Game Commission clashed with legislators over auction tags and an unfair advantage they saw given to a wealthy private citizens group and landowners. The communications indicate wealthy southern Idaho businessman Doug Sayer successfully advocated giving two Fish and Game Commission members the boot. Sayer wrote to Governor Otter's Chief of Staff David Hensley saying, "I must recommend to you that we do not reappoint Mark Doerr or Will Nalon when their term expires in June. It would be unfair to me to complain and not offer a possible solution. I know a couple of candidates that I feel would do a better job, and I would also be willing to sit on a search committee if needed. It is a difficult and severe problem, but when faced with something like this, one also needs to look at the top of the organization and wonder if that individual is part of the problem. In this case, I believe Virgil and especially his deputy director are in fact promoting the culture that we now experience." The email was referring to Fish and Game Director Virgil Moore. Sayer had become frustrated with the Fish and Game Commission and Director Virgil Moore because the commission did not auction game tags more aggressively as a source of revenue and suggests a change of leadership and chemistry is needed. The Idaho Wildlife Federation acquired hundreds of pages of emails from a few state legislators, Governor C.L. Butch Otter and Sayre, through the state's public records law. The organization says the emails show possible collusion between wildlife management and moneyed political interests. Spokesperson Kali Becker with the Idaho Wildlife Federation said, "Idahoans enjoy a world-class wildlife resource thanks to our independent Fish and Game Commission. The strong-arm politics we have unveiled are a direct threat to Idaho sportsmen and the hunting heritage we have built over decades." In 2010, Sayre and lobbyist John Watts of Boise successfully authored Senate Bill 1344, backed by Republican Senator Steve Baer of Blackfoot and Republican Representative Mike Moyle of Starr, which gave the commission authority to issue up to a dozen auction tags, three each for elk, deer, and antelope, and one for moose, elk, and bighorn sheep. The commission, however, declined to implement the auction tags, and the governor declined to reappoint Doerr and Nalon this year. In an email, Representative Baer wrote, "So currently, I have never seen relationships so tenuous and stressed between the legislature and Fish and Game. The department has decided to take a hard policy line this coming session, knowing well that they will never get the fee increases they desire by taking such hard-line positions. In fact, last week, as they reviewed their goals with us, they did not even mention fee increases. I guess they have chosen power of policy over fee increases." Moscow Streets and Fleets Division Manager Tyler Palmer gave the City Council a report last night on how the city dealt with a major water main break on F Street August 25th. Palmer said the call came in to the city from a resident reporting the large water main leak at about 10 a.m. that day.
At noon, all equipment was mobilized to site and we started the excavation. By 4 p.m., we were able to locate, excavate, and open up the water leak and get a visual on it. We ended up having a 20-foot length of 55-year-old 10-inch cast iron water main that was split the whole length. And so, you know, it's something that happens. It's a good reason for us to continue to aggressively update our infrastructure, because when you get these old cast lines, they can cause issues.
Palmer said the time between the reported waterline break on F Street and the time water service was turned back on was 13 hours. He called that turnaround time really impressive based on past experience dealing with other major leaks of that type. Palmer said crews had the new pipe installed by midnight and crews then continued through the night backfilling, flushing the pipe, and taking water samples. However, there was more work done in the month following the waterline break, and the work has not been totally completed yet. Again, Tyler Palmer.
If we're going to fix things, we want to fix them right. And so in the aftermath of this, we had heavy, heavy involvement from a lot of people. First and foremost, our Public Works Director, Les McDonald. The morning after this leak, I had to get on a flight. I had to leave for a flight at 3 a.m., and Les really took over the response from there and just ran the thing and made sure that everything ran smooth. And having a resource like that was really, really helpful to the guys. But we ended up looking at this and saying, you know what, we really need to replace this water line because it was brand new asphalt, and it ended up being a large section of asphalt that was damaged, as you can see in some of these pictures. Here's some pictures of the guys working through the night, getting their shoring in and out so that they can get the pipe button back together. But here's some of the asphalt pictures that you can see. It just, you know, absolutely undermined this asphalt. And so, you know, there was the initial work to be done that we couldn't just open the road back up because we were unsure of the structural stability of the road. And so we always have to consider that. We don't want to send a bunch of traffic back on a road and have a sinkhole underneath it and have somebody really hurt themselves. And so we had to get someone in immediately to pull the asphalt so that we could analyze what the base looked like. And then determine how much asphalt needed to be replaced. When we looked at the amount of asphalt that needed to be replaced, the last thing we want to do is put a whole bunch of new asphalt over more old cast iron pipe. Because, you know, the worst thing we could do is put that asphalt on, have the roller get out on the asphalt, and all of a sudden spring another leak, and then we're paying for $40,000 in asphalt twice. And so that's the last thing that we want to do. And so our engineering department really stepped in at that point and did a fantastic job. They got plans put together. As you guys know, it's late August when this leak sprung. By the time we get the asphalt peeled, we're into early September. And here north of the 45th parallel, asphalt gets harder to get as we get later in the season. And we're relatively geographically isolated. We don't have a ton of asphalt providers, and their schedules are all slammed because everybody's trying to get pavement down this time of year. And with relationships that we've built with some of the contractors in the area, they were willing to help us out and come in and do this job at a reasonable rate to come in and relay a water line so that we have new water line under the entire patch section, the new asphalt. So we're able to get that in, get that tested, and then we're scheduled to pave tomorrow. Mm-hmm. So tomorrow it should pave back.
Nice.
That was Moscow Streets and Fleets Division Director Tyler Palmer speaking at last night's Moscow City Council meeting. Palmer told the council the total cost to the city for dealing with the August 25th F Street waterline break will be $82,000. The Clearwater County Prosecutor's Office has charged 26-year-old Daniel Aldrin with first-degree murder for the death of his 28-day-old infant daughter, Cassandra Lynn Aldrin, who was born April 17th. A judge set Aldrin's bond at $150,000. Public defender Charles Kovas will defend Aldrin. According to a Clearwater County news release, Aldrin's infant died from internal injuries after she was airlifted by Life Flight helicopter to Sacred Heart Medical Center in Spokane. Before the airlift, doctors at Clearwater Valley Hospital in Orofino were unable to properly treat the infant's injuries on May 11th. According to the Clearwater County Sheriff's Office, the Idaho Department of Health and Welfare notified the Sheriff's Office about the child's injuries. Police began an extensive investigation immediately following the child's death. A status hearing is scheduled for November 7th at 9 a.m. in Second District Court. Washington State University police say crews airlifted an 18-year-old man to Sacred Heart Medical Center in Spokane Friday night after he fell approximately 10 feet onto concrete from a second-story deck on the 1000 block of Northeast Monroe Street in Pullman. The unnamed man is listed in critical condition due to injuries to his head. Police say witnesses report the intoxicated man was standing on a bench on the deck when he lost his balance and fell over the railing. The man was unconscious when he was found by emergency personnel. WSU Police Chief Steve Hansen says a 35-year-old Rockford, Washington man is suspected of being the owner of more than $15,000 in counterfeit Cougar merchandise seized by police at Saturday's WSU football game at Martin Stadium in Pullman. Hansen said a warrant to search an unlicensed vendor was executed at about 1:45 p.m. Saturday afternoon at a recreational vehicle parking lot on Ferdinand's Lane. Hansen declined to identify the man who has yet to be charged while investigations continue. Hansen told the Lewiston Tribune a total of 759 T-shirts and sweatshirts were seized, worth an estimated $15,500. The suspect could face felony counterfeiting Class C charges. Whitman County deputies, Fire District 8 responders, and emergency personnel responded to a fatal all-terrain vehicle collision Friday night. According to the Daily News, the accident claimed the life of 18-year-old Eric C. Ellison of Kennewick, who lost control of his side-by-side ATV and was ejected. The vehicle came to rest on top of him. Members of Ellison's hunting party found him on Meeker Road. The hunters attempted CPR but were unable to revive him. Ellison had not been seen by his party for some time before they began searching for him. You're listening to the KRFP Evening Report. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman. The Pullman City Council will be asked tonight to ratify the execution of three Washington Department of Transportation grant applications for Pullman Transit operations and improvements. One would be an operating assistance grant for sustaining Pullman Transit fixed route service. The second would be for an operating assistance grant for sustaining Pullman Transit's dial-a-ride service, and the third would be an operational service expansion grant to provide holiday-level service on Sundays and to provide greater daily frequency on express routes by adding 1 hour daily to each of six morning routes. The City Council is also expected to vote on a resolution authorizing the execution of an interlocal agreement between the City and National Purchasing Partners. The City is using National Purchasing Partners as a contracting agency participating in cooperative purchasing of self-contained breathing apparatus equipment and portable radios available to the city under a FEMA Assistance to Firefighters grant. Tonight's Pullman City Council meeting begins at 7 p.m. at City Hall. Today we bring you the second of two candidate interviews for Idaho House Seat 5A. Republican Carl Berglund of Deary is running against one-term Democratic incumbent Paulette Jordan of Plummer. You heard from Berglund yesterday. Today we bring you our interview with candidate Paulette Jordan.
Morning. We're with Paulette Jordan, who is running for Seat 5B?
A.
In the Idaho House, and your opponent is Carl Berglund. And we've seen Republican candidates from the right wing of the Republican Party lately in races in Latah County or District 5. In the past, moderate Republicans got elected in Latah County. Do you think the current District 5 lineup of candidates might get a bump from the Trump candidacy?
That depends. I think what we're seeing here is just a vastly huge contrast between those who are in the Democratic Party versus those who are in the Republican Party. And with both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump at the top of the ticket, it certainly is driving people one way or the other. But I do like to point out that within our ticket, meaning Dan Schmidt, Senator Schmidt, and myself, and now Laureen, that we tend to be very broadly moderate and more sensible. I think we're quite fair, whether we're moderate Republican-leaning or progressive Democrats. I just feel that it's really about keeping everyone in mind and being fair, sensible.
Okay. What are the issues you can have the most impact on as an elected Democrat in the Idaho legislature? Or what are the issues you want to have the most impact on?
As a young person, especially representing the millennial voice, my concern is looking into the future for the next seven generations and what are the impacts on our young folks. And to me, that's going to be whether we're able to focus on providing a world-class education for our youth and preparing them to be the next set of professionals and not just taking on low-wage jobs, barely getting by, being more lenient on the government for social programs. Because people want to work hard, they want to be paid their fair share, and I think that corporations aren't paying their fair share. I also see the environment becoming an issue. People who are more informed about this local Palouse aquifer, they should be well aware that a lot of our aquifers throughout the U.S. are in danger, and a part of that is in aim to the corporations who have taken over and are giving more of a say on the national level and local. So I feel for our future generations, what they have to inherit should be something that would be set up in a fair way. That's, you know, being able to inherit a beautiful set of land that isn't privatized, that is kept public for access to everyone, or that the educational system is setting them up to compete within the national world, or just even to compete within our local society, because I feel that that's one of the biggest struggles. Even as a mother, I see that because I want my own children to compete. So I'm keeping that in mind as a legislator, and I'm also looking at the taxpayers' bottom line, because everyone has to pay their fair share. So that means that taxes are coming into play, and how we spend those taxes, to me, we need to be more conservative in that regard. So fiscal conservatism includes being responsible, but being wise and looking at what we're spending and what we're investing into. And within our state, we've invested more into bedding those within our prison systems than we are into sending our kids to school. So we're reaching 60,000 per inmate versus 6,500 per student.
Okay, and your opponent mentioned on the topic of education that the state needs to improve, I believe he was getting at efficiency in the education system rather than throwing more money at it. He said what kids are taught, he implied that what kids are taught can be improved without, raising the funding for education significantly. What are your thoughts on that?
I think we have to be realistic. For those of us who are familiar with running large budgets, you're looking at multiple levels of mass spending going in the wrong direction. First of all, our JFAC, our Joint Finance and Appropriations Committee, they will hear out all the tax exemptions, which are nearing $2 billion for big corporations, most of them not even in the state, before they'll hear out all the education bills. So education funding comes last, which for one is wrong. If you're going to prioritize education, then put your money where your mouth is and ensure that public funding for education is prioritized at the beginning of the fiscal year or the beginning of the legislative session. So leadership is required there. When we lack leadership there, no one holds to it, and they're just giving a lot of lip service, then the people are going to feel it back home. I don't think we're throwing money anywhere when it comes to education. I think that's where we lack, in fact, because we're still at 2009 funding levels. So we're doing a complete injustice. We're not holding up to our constitutional responsibilities as a legislature. And I think that's where we need to take a hard look and ensure that we're adhering to those responsibilities. But to me, it's called investment. And as, again, a mother of two sons, I know best when it comes to education as far as how we're truly investing into our people. We're looking at newer technologies, updating curriculum, textbooks, even providing for those teachers who are educating themselves and coming into the workforce. We have to look at the entire picture. And we have schools that are crumbling. There are a lot of outdated systems. And so if we're not addressing every single issue here that comes into play within the educational structure, then we're only setting ourselves up for failure.
What are your thoughts about the prospects of closing the healthcare coverage gap in Idaho? It's been such a huge issue, and yet not necessarily the first thing lawmakers look at when they arrive in Boise.
The frustration is seeing politicians up and down the state argue about why expanding Medicaid is not a good idea. Now, for myself, as a progressive, I support more universal health care, but I do support this as a step in the right direction. I would like to see our state just get to it and quit dragging their feet on the issue. We're losing millions as we speak. We would save our taxpayers up and down a load of money, but also serve those who right now aren't being serviced, who are caught in the gap, as they say. So the Medicaid gap right near now includes over 78,000 people within the state. We've had letters from families who have died because they were not able to have access to adequate health care. And it's a sad situation because no one really cares until it's them being impacted or someone that they know being impacted. Myself being a member of the Fraternal Order of the Eagles and Post 5 up north, I see my brothers and sisters who are veterans struggling, and it's frustrating for me because they shouldn't have to struggle after serving. They fought hard, they sacrifice, and some don't ever make it back. But now we're seeing roughly 10,000 plus veterans who are also caught in this gap, and I think it's a complete injustice and highly inhumane.
Don't veterans have a separate healthcare system under the Veterans Administration? How does the Affordable Care Act coverage and the Veterans Administration how do those two things parse out for people who are veterans?
Well, veterans are people too.
Yeah,
they're citizens of the United States just as we are. But I think that, and this is a great question for local hospitals and clinics. But one of the facts that I've seen is one, lacking access through transportation for veterans, some who go to local clinics and are having trouble getting through their VA. We've seen one of our representatives who was here in the north somehow not receive funding, so now there's only one rep who's out of Boise, so it's really difficult to maintain or just even catch up with that representative for a meeting. But that's not part of the system that I'm familiar with in terms of the VA, because I'm not a veteran, but I fully support our veterans in every which way possible. So fighting for them on behavioral health or access to Medicaid, Medicare, that's where I'm at. But seeing those 10,000 who are caught on the gap, my assumption is that they're caught on the gap based off of their income.
Okay. Last night it was pretty clear where the candidates stand on minimum wage and also the minimum wage preemption law that was passed by the legislature this year that prohibits cities or counties from enacting their own minimum wages. But there's a lot of other laws, legislation that is proposed down in Boise that impacts employers and employees. It seems over the years the legislature has been trying to reduce the impact of the teachers' bargaining power by insisting the bargaining by making a law that the teachers must negotiate in public with the school districts. There was a law proposed last year making it easier for employers to sue ex-employees for violating non-compete laws or non-compete contract provisions. I mean, talk about some of these other issues that that impact labor in Idaho.
That's a broad question, but I'll do my best to be succinct in that regard. So there are a lot of bills that were aimed at restricting local control, aimed at restricting workers' rights in terms of compensation, or like the non-compete bill, which is now law. All those are frustrating because what we're seeing is a direct attack on the people, the common good. So I don't see that as being a plus for the people, especially when it comes to restricting the rights of our teachers. We're seeing a lot of them leave our state for surrounding neighboring states, which is entirely unfortunate because we're seeing that pool shrink every year. And especially when it comes to professional workforce, they're jumping ship and they're going to other states where they're seeing a less hostile environment. So the tragedy here is that we're going to be taking the hit within our local economy, taking the hit within our local schools, even our University of Idaho. We're seeing that hit directly. A lot of our professors, good teachers, are leaving for better pay or better work environments where they're going to be respected. Because as anyone, if you look at this in the big picture, we're all human beings. We all deserve to be treated with respect. But with these laws, they're all from the career ladder on to the non-compete bill. They're all just entirely a slap in the face.
Okay. In 2015, the legislature passed a law on concealed weapons saying that you don't need a permit for carrying them outside city limits. This year, they passed a law saying you could basically carry a concealed weapon anywhere without a permit. There's also a law in 2015 prohibiting the universities from regulating concealed weapons in most of their most university buildings if the person does have a concealed weapons permit or an enhanced concealed weapons permit. What are your thoughts about these changes in the rules regarding where and how people can carry loaded firearms?
Well, back in 2012, I was very clear that I would not support the guns on campus bill, which is also now law.
Was that 2012, that long ago?
Yes. So, 2012 it was brought up, and then 2014.
Oh, okay.
Let me see the exact year. Yeah, 2012, I believe.
Okay.
So, you get me all.
right. Yeah, with the dates.
Yes. So, going back to that, I think that, you know, the strategy for the Second Amendment Alliance group, for example, has been very aggressive, and I think that it's unfortunate for Idahoans because most of the people who I know, even myself as a gun owner and relatives who own their own plethora of guns, and my uncle who's a gun shop owner, you know, a lot of us, we grew up hunting and fishing within these backwoods, and being a lifelong resident of this area, I've known a lot of those folks who are out there just, you know, with the right to own a gun and the right to practice to use it, but we've also been very comfortable and secure with knowing that if our neighbor was to own a gun, that he would be trained and certified. So I'm going to stick to it, and I've held to that because I believe that we should be trained and certified. So it's unfortunate that people are put in this situation and feeling uncomfortable. And I think it's just created just this lack of safety concern for most of the people in our neighborhoods. But I felt that if we had this law for over 100 years, why change it? But it happened last year, and sometimes certain folks can be very aggressive, and those who are in office feel it, especially when they're getting calls at their homes and being threatened. So it's unfortunate, but sometimes this is the life you lead, and to stand in the forefront, you do have to take those hits. But for those like me, I wasn't willing to bend over backwards just to be bullied by it.
Okay, the legislature has taken a lot of criticism for over the years for passing laws that limit how women can get abortions or access to abortions. And the criticism comes mainly because these laws get ruled unconstitutional by federal courts, and then the state of Idaho is paying tens, hundreds of thousands of dollars in, fighting to keep the laws from being declared unconstitutional in court. So what are your thoughts on this whole situation that's been going on for basically decades in the legislature?
Right. We tend to lose millions through our Constitutional Defense Fund just because our governor or the certain side of our legislature believes that they want to take on their religious beliefs, their personal opinions, challenging a law. To me, I'm a mother of two. I've never been a proponent of abortion. I've been primarily pro-prevention, pro-family planning. Mm-hmm. I believe as a woman that we have the right to choose, and I don't feel that government should infringe upon any woman's rights to have that particular relationship with her doctor or with their own body. So to me, that's where government goes too far. And to me, it also means for those who believe that restricting a woman to have access to those rights, that they have gone too far, and they need to rethink that and reconsider where they stand on this particular issue for that very reason. But when it comes to these laws, a lot of them, you know, there's a bill about fetal tissue at the end of the session, and there's no fetal tissue development, even through the Planned Parenthood centers. They've even proclaimed publicly time and again that they have never done any fetal tissue research or developments within their centers. But yet there's always those representatives who are in the legislature who are kind of chasing their own shadow. And it comes out very often in the state. So that's one of my frustrations, because it's a big waste of both taxpayers' dimes and their time. So we can do better. We need to be more efficient. But wasting our money on fetal tissue bills that don't exist, or just chasing our own shadows, does no one any good.
Okay, anything you'd like to add? We're going a little over time, but if any final thoughts?
I just want to thank everybody for their kind support. I get a lot of people on the streets who will just give me encouragement, and I really do appreciate all the prayers and the love from our constituent base here. It is really a team effort. We all work together. And I just want to remind everybody that, you know, everyone wants change, but no one's willing to stand up to make that change. Senator Schmidt, myself, and now we have a new team member, Laureen, we're willing to make that change. And it takes someone with a strong background, a strong integrity, and willingness to do that.
Okay.
That was Democratic Idaho House Seat 5A candidate, incumbent Paulette Jordan of Plummer. Jordan's opponent is Republican challenger Carl Berglund of Deary, who you may have heard yesterday on Morning Mix or Evening Report. Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Take a look at the weather forecast for the Moscow Pullman area. 20% chance of isolated showers between 8 p.m. and midnight tonight. Otherwise, mostly cloudy, low 38. Mostly sunny tomorrow, high 52. 70% chance of rain Wednesday night after midnight. Mostly cloudy, low 43. 80% chance of rain Thursday, high 53. 80% chance of rain mainly before midnight Thursday night, low 45, and a 30% chance of rain mainly in the afternoon Friday, mostly cloudy, high 53. Currently reporting fair skies, 48 degrees at the Pullman-Moscow Regional Airport. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 $5 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. That's KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Or you can go to the KRFP website to find out more ways to help KRFP. I'm Lee Robartis. Jim Roach assists with tonight's newscast. Have a pleasant evening. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman, community radio for the Palouse at 90.3 on your FM dial and online. Coming up, a weekly documentary from the National Radio Project, and at about 6:35, we'll